Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, January the 21st, Martin Luther King Day. The state of Wisconsin honors Dr. King with an annual ceremony in the state's Capitol Rotunda. That ceremony takes place at noon today, and the tribute will be broadcast live on the Ideas Network. The rebroadcast will be at 7 o'clock tonight on Wisconsin Public Television. We are going to talk with an author this hour who is also a physician who will be in Wisconsin 1 week from today to talk about her national bestseller, Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality. We will talk about end-of-life issues and end-of-life care, and we will welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest. Have you had to deal with this, being the family of a loved one who died, and have anything to say about how the doctor and the medical establishment helped you or maybe didn't help you when it came to those final moments? We will talk with our guest, and we will welcome your questions and stories for her at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are happy to have with us Pauline Chen, Dr. Pauline Chen. She completed her surgical training at Yale University and UCLA, where she was most recently a member of the faculty. At Yale, she was the recipient of the Betsy Winters House Staff Teaching Award and the George Longstreth Humanness Award for exemplifying empathy, kindness, and care in an age of advancing technology. She is author of Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality, which has just been reissued in paperback. She will be at Harry Schwartz Bookshop in Shorewood on Monday, January the 28th at 7 o'clock. I'll give you a number a little bit later as to a number you can call for more information for that event. And Dr. Chen joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm honored to be on your show.
Yeah, this book came out about a year ago to all sorts of attention and praise because you really struck a chord. Apparently, end-of-life issues are ones that needed to be talked about.
Yeah, you know, I think death, no matter how you look at it, is difficult. And it's very difficult, obviously, for the patients who are dying and their families, but it's also really difficult for physicians. I think most doctors go into the field wanting to help people, pretty passionately so. But a lot of us believe that helping patients means curing them. And what we don't realize is that death is as much a part of our profession as curing. And in many ways, it's more present in our work lives than we believe. You know, there's an interesting statistic that shows that the average number of deaths that a physician in training sees is 28 per year. So that's about one every 2 weeks. And when that happens over and over and over again, I think you can't help but feel something about it and think about it and wonder, you know, how we die, how we help people that die, or how we don't help people that die. Yeah. So I think for everybody, it's something that, you know, we think about, but we don't talk about.
Yeah, not very much. Maybe more so than we used to. But
yes.
just yesterday, I always tell stories about my husband on this program. But I brought up your book, and we were talking about a relative, my brother-in-law's uncle died, and we were talking about his request for his service. And I said, "Well, would you want that kind of thing at your funeral?" And he's like, I don't want to talk about that now. Let's not talk about this now. And people don't really want to talk about the end of our own lives.
Right. And it's very hard. And it's as hard for doctors and healthcare providers as it is for non-doctors and people who have nothing to do with the healthcare system. But I think that when we don't talk about it, I mean, I agree it's really difficult to talk about it, but when we don't talk about it, we really do ourselves and those we love a disservice. It's, you know, when you are at a hospital or when your loved one's at a hospital, I think being in a hospital is pretty scary if you don't work there, and even sometimes when you work there.
Mm-hmm.
But to be there when a loved one is at the end of life is frightening. And to have to make decisions about that person's end of life, especially if that person is not able to, is not quote-unquote competent to at that moment, it's really, really scary and difficult to do that without any idea of what that person might have wanted. That a lot of people feel, in my experience, a lot of families feel that when that moment comes, that they don't want the responsibility for, quote-unquote, pulling the plug,
mm-hmm.
when, in fact, sometimes taking, you know, ramping down, going down on some of the aggressive care may be, in fact, the most compassionate thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I hope Final Exam does is, you know, when I wrote Final Exam, the thing that I tried to do was be as honest as I could about my own experiences, which was pretty difficult. But I hope that it inspires in some way other people to talk about what they want at the end of life or how they envision their end of life, because it is difficult to talk about, but it's an act of courage to talk about it. And it's really a gift that you can give to your family members, to your doctor. And for doctors, it's a gift that you can give your patients, that they will know that when that time comes, their doctor will be there and will know what they've wanted.
Yeah. Tell the story about the gentleman who wanted to die at home, and you did have then a decision to make along with him and his family. You could put him in intensive care and really ramp up the chemotherapy or whatever else needed to be done, or you could let him go home.
Yeah. This patient, actually, this happened in the middle of my surgical residency. And, you know, I am not the perfect doctor by any means. I would love to be that way, but, you know, I struggle with this myself. And when I started medical school, I was like everybody else there. I really believed that my job was to cure patients. I had this vision of patients coming into my office and, you know, slapping me on the back and saying, thanks, doc, mm-hmm. you know, and being all better. So I believe this, and I embrace this kind of thinking. Actually, it's interesting, medical sociologists call this culture the informal curriculum. It's sort of the culture around, the professional culture around medicine, what we learn very subtly. The people don't say, well, you know, deny that people are dying. It's just by gestures and language. So I embrace that fully, and I embrace the idea that my job was to cure people.
Mm-hmm.
But then in my third year of surgical residency, right in the middle of it, I took care of a gentleman who was a businessman who had metastatic colon cancer that had spread. And I remember rounding on him a couple times a day. And every time I went to his room, his wife would be there, and she would take me outside of the room, and she'd say, my husband really wants to die at home. I know he's going to die. You know, when can we get him home? And I would tell her, well, we're working on it. We're working on it. As it turned out, he did not get better, and we had to transfer him to the ICU. And I was on call one night, and it was around 3 or 4 in the morning, and I realized that this man was not going to get any better, and that, in fact, he probably would not survive until the morning. So I called the attending surgeon, the surgeon responsible for his case, and I called the wife, and they both came into the ICU in the middle of the night, and she looked devastated. She was crying, and so I went to bring the attending surgeon and the wife into the patient's room in the ICU. Now, there's part of the informal curriculum that I had learned as a resident was that when patients die in the ICU, you leave them alone with their families. we somehow had believed that what they really want is their privacy. So as a doctor, you just scatter. Mm-hmm. And so I brought the attending surgeon and the wife to the room, fully expecting the attending surgeon to come out with me and for us to leave the wife in there alone. But when I left the room, I realized I was the only one that had left, that the surgeon and the wife were still in there. And so I thought, wow, this is strange. Mm-hmm. And so I waited outside for a while, waiting for the surgeon to come out, my teacher. And when he didn't come out, I finally looked back in. And what I saw there, Joy, I have never forgotten. What he was doing was pointing to the monitors in the patient's room and explaining to the man's wife, the patient's wife, that these were how the last rhythms of life looked. And then he pointed to the patient's chest and explained to her that at the end of life, people's breathing changes and not to be alarmed. And then he touched the man's arm and he said to her that her presence there, even though her husband seemed to not be with us, seemed to be comatose, that her presence there gave her husband great comfort at the end of life. And I never forgot that. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, I tried. I didn't always succeed, but I tried to do what that surgeon did. And that moment made me realize that as doctors, as healthcare providers, we could do more than just cure. We could be there for our patients and our patients' families. And it's interesting because a couple of weeks after that happened, I received a card from the patient's wife, and in it she wrote that, you know, she was sorry that he couldn't go home to die as they had hoped, but that she believed that he had had the kind of death that they had always hoped for, that it was dignified and peaceful. And I kept that card for a long mm-hmm. time in my coat pocket, and I've never forgotten that.
We are going to take calls and questions for Dr. Pauline Chen, talking about her book, Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, if you would like to join in with an experience or a question. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. The UW-Milwaukee Institute of World Affairs begins its weekly Great Decisions series on Tuesday, and every Monday, Ben will talk with the week's guest speaker. At 5 today, Ben and his guest will discuss how America can improve its image in the world. That's At Issue with Ben Marins after 5 today. We're talking about end-of-life issues and end-of-life care with a physician, a surgeon, who wrote a book about her experiences. She is Pauline Chen. The book is Final Exam. She will be speaking to a Wisconsin audience next week, Monday, the 28th of January, at the Harry Schwartz Bookshop in Shorewood. For more information on that appearance, you can call Harry Schwartz at 414-963-3111. We're going to go to the phones right away. Lots of callers who I'm sure have stories or questions. Juanita in Madison is first. Hi, Juanita. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I would like to make a comment. I am a nurse, and I read these books about the doctors writing their stories, and actually I read them about nurses too. And as I'm packing to go to see my sister who has lung cancer and expecting surgery this week, I'd like to remind people that nurses don't scatter, and I'm using the doctor's word, not mine, but that we stay there. We help people in and out of lives with a great deal of skill. And I just think that should be acknowledged.
Dr. Chen?
I absolutely agree. You know, it's interesting because people have asked, you know, well, who taught you these lessons or who changed your, you know, the way you viewed things? And I told the story about an attending surgeon, but there are lots of people. There are lots of people in the hospital that have been unbelievable teachers, the patients, their families, nurses, social workers, chaplains, respiratory therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists. There's a wonderful community in the hospital. And the nurses in particular, one story that I like to tell about them is that surgical residency is tough. You're really busy and there's not very much time for anything, and you're always trying to scramble so that you can get your 15 minutes of sleep. And one of the things that surgical residents, and I was notorious for doing, was forgetting to talk to the family because you just wanted to get the work done and get your rest or get your first meal. And it was always the nurses who reminded me of that, who always said, Pauline, don't forget the family. Or, Pauline, you've got to talk to the husband or the wife or the kids. And they really helped me to understand that the families are the ones who, after the patient dies, are left picking up a lot of the pieces and are left with a lot of the memories of how it happened and what happened. And that those memories, you know, as a doctor, you really have the ability to make those memories not so much of a burden or not so much. Let me put it this way. It's been interesting because one of the amazing things about meeting people at readings and at different talks has been meeting these families who have told me about quite courageously about their stories in the hospital and what happened. And it's always very sad when you hear about somebody who misses their loved one. I mean, it's quite moving. But what's really heartbreaking is when these family members not only remember that, but they remember the fact that they felt like no one talked to them, the doctors didn't tell them what was happening, or that their family member was in pain at the end of life, or, you know, something like that. And so I know that as a resident and as an attending, the nurses were great with reminding me about that, and so I'm very grateful for that. So Juanita is absolutely correct.
Juanita, thank you so much for the call, and so sorry about your sister's diagnosis.
Thank you.
Yeah. Katie in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, Katie.
Hello. I guess I'm also going to echo what Juanita said about the nurses being truly just a great support system when you're caring for someone and sharing that time at the end of life with a person that you love. And also to really just thank the medical professionals out there who do take the time to spend time with the family to explain what's happening and to be a little more available, because I did experience that with my mom's death and a certain radiologist and a certain nurse also who just truly took time with us, and I will never forget that. I'm just truly thankful.
Yeah, thank you very much. Reaction, Dr. Chen?
Yes, you know, I think people that take the time to do that are really, I think, really, really admirable, particularly in light of the fact that even for the most compassionate and idealistic of us, you know, doctors, I guess I'm speaking more specifically about doctors, there are so many limitations imposed by the healthcare system that, you know, particularly in regards to time, so that even if you want to spend a lot of time with your patient, or even if you do, you aren't often given the time, and you're oftentimes penalized for spending more time with a patient. you know, when you think about, there's an interesting study that shows that the average amount of time that a doctor will spend talking to a patient about advanced directives, which are really important, is 5 minutes. And when you think about that number in absolute terms, that's ludicrous, 5 minutes. But when you put it in the context of, you know, when is a doctor going to talk about this? Probably at a return visit. And a return visit, on average, is 15 to 20 minutes. And during that visit, that doctor also has to do a history and physical, go through diagnoses, prescribe. I mean, there's so many things that have to be done. So in that context, 5 minutes is actually seems, you know, quite substantial. I think that people who do spend the time are wonderful because you know that they're doing it against a lot of obstacles. The other thing about nurses and other healthcare professionals, like Katie mentioned, the radiologist, who are wonderful, is that there are some wonderful experts out there in end-of-life care, and they have, for the last 25 years, been really pushing some reform efforts. And I would say that some of the changes that we see, for instance, in medical education, in training, is because of those efforts. And I hope that my book in some way supports those efforts. There are some great examples. For instance, a lot of medical specialties and surgical special training residencies, they now require exposure to palliative care, whereas when I was going through training, nobody ever thought about that. Palliative care is now considered its own medical specialty, so it's sort of like cardiology or gastroenterology, and that was a change that was made in the last couple of years, which I think is an important value statement on the part of the medical community. So there are definitely people out there that are really wonderful and are really doing a great job at pushing forward reform. Yeah. That being said, there's still a long ways to go.
Yeah. Now, you were your specialty was
transplants.
Transplants, yeah, transplants. And you're not actively practicing at the moment?
No, I'm not right now. I'm actually concentrating mostly on the writing, but I am in the process of getting credentialed to work in an emergency room, actually.
Hmm.
At the West Roxbury VA, which I'm very excited about. I'm excited to serve that population.
Yeah, tell the story about, I believe you were procuring organs from a donor, and it turned out the donor was an Asian-American woman about the same age you were at the time.
Yes. I was in in my fellowship in transplantation out at UCLA, and what happens when you are a fellow in transplantation is you learn not only to transplant the organs, but you also learn to procure the organs. And most of the organs that we procured were from patients who were brain dead.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, I went out to do a procurement to get an organ for a patient who was in our ICU and waiting for a liver, and went out to the hospital and went into the operating room and you know, like most operations, after you do several, there is a certain rhythm to the operation, a certain routine to the operation that you become very comfortable with. And this particular operation, this particular one, was something I had already done over 80 of these, so I really knew the operation. And so when I walked into that operating room, I was pretty confident about being able to get the organ safely and to do a nice, respectful job to the donor as well as to the waiting recipient. But when I went into that operating room, I saw on the table an Asian American woman who was about my age at the time. I was in my mid-30s. And I sort of stopped because I had never done a procurement mm-hmm. on a woman who looked so much like me or who had so much of a similar background. So I sort of put that aside and went about draping the patient as we do, taking sterile cloth and sort of covering the patient up, except for a small strip which would go from the base of your neck down to your pubic bone, and that's where we made the incision to get at the organs. So I went about that with the surgeon that had gone with me, trying not to think too hard about what I had seen. And eventually, when the patient was covered, I sort of kind of forgot it. But as we started to make the incision, the drapes where I was standing at the woman's the upper part of her torso, her chest, the drapes fell away, and I saw the woman's breast. And I stopped. I couldn't continue cutting because it was as if I had stepped out of the shower and was looking at the mirror at myself. Mm-hmm. Everything about that woman's chest, the way her ribs poked through, her ribs, you could see the undulations of her ribs, the fall of her breast, the way her chest was. I couldn't keep going. But I realized I had to. I had to because I had to do this for the patient back home. And the other surgeon that was with me was very kind, and he said, are you okay? Because he had noticed that I had stopped. And I said, yes, I'm okay. And I put the drape back over the woman's chest and continued to operate. But the drape kept falling, and I kept seeing the woman's chest, and I kept seeing myself there. And after that operation, I felt, as we were leaving in the helicopter to bring the organs back to our hospital, I kept thinking about what I had seen, and I was exhausted. It was the middle of the night. I'd been up for several nights straight, but I remember feeling this profound grief, and I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And it wasn't until I began writing about it, until I began really sitting back and thinking about the things that I had gone through, that I realized that I had caught a glimpse of my own mortality. And it's something that none of us likes to accept. Freud put it really well. He said that, you know, it's really pretty easy for us to accept that other people are going to die, that strangers are going to die. But when it comes to ourselves or our loved ones, we can't even imagine a world without ourselves. And so here I was face to face with that fact. And I think that was sort of the beginning of my wanting to write this book. Mm.
We'll go now to Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hello. It occurs to me that people that delve into this area are often not welcomed. And some other time I'd love to hear about what must have been ready criticism of the speaker's willingness to delve into this topic. Anybody that's spent a lot of time working with either animals or the elderly, as I have, quickly comes to realize in many ways the veterinarians are way ahead of the average doctor, in part because they're not under the pressure from family members. But I well remember the first time I took a favorite pet into a vet that had contracted a bad disease at a relatively early age, and I was frantically trying intervention after intervention. And at one point, the vet looked at me and said quietly but firmly, "The animal's trying to die." And I'll never forget it, because for the first time, I started thinking about the fact that everything does have a life cycle, and you can prolong it, but the quality of life is not good. And when I started working with the elderly, God help me, I was just horrified at their day-to-day existence, which goes on almost unnoticed by most people, at the same time that we seem to be encouraging the medical profession to frantically try to extend life. I remember talking to a nurse that works with the elderly that said the majority of their patients are put on heavy doses of antidepressants when they enter these facilities, and they generally stay on them. And I remember looking at her and saying, why would you do that? And she said, well, they have to survive. And at the time, I thought, why? And once I started working with the elderly, I thought that even more. Why? They can't see well. They can't hear well. They're miserable. They can't focus on anything. And you can keep people going for years. Now, we already have this happy plan for the kind of birth everybody wants of their baby. There's got to be a way to start talking about the kind of death plan people want.
Yeah, and Mary, I'd like to talk to you more, but the quality of the phone line makes it difficult to hear what you're saying. But I wanted, Dr. Chen, your reaction to that story?
Mary, I agree with you. If we put at least even a small percentage of the planning that we put into births, into deaths, I think we would all benefit from it in some way. You know, you mentioned veterinarians, and I agree with you. They are often much better than human doctors. My dog actually passed away last week, and he was 14 and a half, 15 years old. And at the very end, my husband and I had to bring him to the vets. And she was terrific. She was everything that I had written about. And what was also interesting to me was that, you know, despite having thought about this a lot, despite having written about this, despite having talked about this, that it was still very, very hard to lose Isaac. And so I think it brought home the point that death is difficult, but I do have to say that the fact that I had thought about it made me a little more prepared about what to expect and to have thought through these issues beforehand, I think was really important. Mary asked also about if I had received, what kind of criticism I had received in regards to writing the book. I have to say that I was pretty anxious before the book came out, because when I was writing it, it was just me and my computer and my belief that I had to be as honest as possible. But before it came out, I thought, oh no, there I am on the page. But what has been immensely satisfying and affirming is the fact that people that the book has resonated with people, and that the book has resonated with my colleagues. A friend of mine saw a man that I had worked with, a physician I had worked with for several years, quite closely. And this doctor said to my friend that he read the book and he had gone through so many of the same things, and he didn't realize that I had felt the same way. And so that was thrilling for me, that other people felt the same way. What was sad for me about that was, so the difficult part for me has not been criticism, but it's been the fact that we haven't talked about it. Here was a man that I had spent 4 years working closely with, and we never talked about the fact that it was difficult to see our patients die, that it was difficult to be present for our patients as much as we wanted to. And instead, we just went on with our work. We soldiered alone. And so I hope that the book will make us begin to talk. And I've felt some of that already. I mean, it's been really wonderful to talk to colleagues. And I'm talking about all healthcare professionals. It's been wonderful to talk to patients and their families, because we're beginning to talk about this topic, about dying, about how we want to die, how others want to die, how we can improve, and how we can support some of the efforts that have already taken place to change things.
We are talking about dying, and we're talking about end-of-life care, medical care, and end-of-life decisions with a physician, a surgeon, Pauline Chen, who wrote about her experiences in the best-selling book Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality. The book has just been reissued in paperback, and Dr. Chen will be in Wisconsin next week, Monday, talking at the Harry Schwartz Bookshop in Shorewood. That's Monday, January 28th at 7 p.m. You can talk to her right now at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you, and it's all things political. After 9, Kathleen and her guests will look at race and gender in American politics. That's coming up in our next hour. After 10, in honor of Martin Luther King Day, Kathleen and her guest will recall his famous speech, I Have a Dream. So stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about doctors and how they take care of the dying. And our guest is Pauline Chen. She's a physician who wrote the book Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality. Heidi in Toma is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes, go ahead.
Can you understand me? Oh, okay. I was just listening to the show. I didn't listen to the first part of it, but as I was listening, I was thinking about my own experience in being a nurse, and I worked with the elderly for a number of years as a nurse's aide, and then I became a nurse. And one of my dreams after working with elderly people and seeing the way they die in nursing homes was to always work in hospice. And when I moved here to Toma, I got to work in hospice before my children were born, and it was the most amazing job I ever had. It's the most privileged thing that you can do to help a family and their loved ones through that last stage of life and to help all of them if you can. Some of them don't always come to terms with their death, but just being there for the families and helping them through that transition and the loved one that's passing, knowing that you're helping making them comfortable and that you're giving them the best death that they can hopefully have. And I just wanted to comment about that.
Heidi, thank you very much. Some words on hospice, Dr. Chen?
I think Heidi's absolutely right. First of all, I think hospice is terrific. And I think the only problem with hospice is that many of us don't enroll in hospice soon enough. Mm-hmm. Hospice has terrific support programs, people like Heidi working there, who can help not only the patients during the end of life, but also their families. And one hospice worker put it really well to me. She said, you know, we don't help people to die. We help people to live. And they really do. They help you to live fully all the way through. And they help families. But they need more time than 2 days, which oftentimes people don't enroll in hospice until the last couple of days of death. I also want to echo Heidi's statement about how working with the dying can be so enriching. People have asked me, well, you know, when patients die, isn't that depressing? And that's what I would have thought when I started medical training, surgical training. But now I feel very much the way Heidi does, that people at the end of life and their families can be unbelievably generous. There, one story that comes to mind all the time is when I was in training and working pretty hard, there was a young person that was dying, and I tried to do everything that I could to help that young person at the end of life and that person's family. And a couple of weeks before that person died, one of the family members came up to me and said, Dr. Chen, you know, we really appreciate what you're doing for us. I mean, you've been great. And so then I said, thank you. And then I said, you know, this really means a lot to me. And they said, yes, but we want you to have a life too. We want you to go out and be out of the hospital sometime. Mm. And I was so moved because here in their, one of their most difficult moments, they were thinking about me. And it's interesting because when I was writing the book, I started doing some research about this because it just struck me as extraordinary that people at the end of life were so giving. And I mean, and I agree with Heidi, not everybody gets there. I mean, there's some people that have difficulty accepting the end of life, but a lot of people are really wonderful. And so I came upon an interesting study that looked at factors that patients felt and families felt made their deaths a dignified one or a good death. What mm-hmm. constituted a good death? And what the researchers found were sort of all the things that you would expect. But the one thing that surprised them was that they found something that they called generativity, that is, giving to other people, doing something, teaching other people or doing something for other people, was just as important a part of creating a good death as being pain-free. I mean, I thought that was remarkable in the sense that, you know, here in study form is confirmation of all that I've seen or experienced, been lucky enough to experience, really.
Well, that reminds me of a story that was in the newscast before we began, and it's a piece of legislation that will get a public hearing at our state capitol here in Wisconsin this week. It is called Death with Dignity legislation, and it would allow physician-assisted suicide in the case of terminally ill patients. Do you have any thoughts on legislation like that? Have you ever been in this type of situation where maybe you were even asked to help someone die?
You know, I have never been asked, mm-hmm. But you know, my feeling on that, and I guess what I'm sort of working on right now with final exam, is my sense is that the current system as stands is pretty inadequate sort of across the board in providing, we don't do the optimal job of providing good palliative care as is. Yes, there are some wonderful docs out there, wonderful nurses, wonderful healthcare professionals out there that do a great job, but I don't think that across the board, we can say that with confidence. There are still people, and I've had family members, you know, in the hospital that, you know, are still in pain, that, you know, hospice is not brought up at a time that is appropriate. So I guess my feeling right now is that I would like to see the current system optimized, you know, as much as possible. I would like to see good palliative care out there and feel comfortable with what we're offering patients and then start to think about other steps for people at the end of life. You know, for instance, pain. Pain management now is so much farther advanced than it was 10 or 15 years ago. There are really wonderful pain management specialists out there, but we don't always use them, and we don't always use them effectively in end-of-life care, and we need to be able to do that consistently, I think, for patients. So I think that there are a lot of holes still in the current system that, you know, we can repair them, but it's going to take a while.
Yeah, Tom in Burlington. Hi, you're on the air.
I talked to a Vietnam veteran who had been dead, and he came back to life. And he said, I liked it better when I was dead. But getting to your point I think we've always had this underwritten or under-the-table concept of helping somebody die. They gave them more morphine, or they withhold water or something and let them sort of drift off. And I'd like to say, all the nurses are so selfless. They're just wonderful what they do to help people.
Yeah. Is there some sort of unwritten rule that in some cases some doctors may just put a little bit more morphine in somebody's IV or something along those lines?
I think it's there have been pieces written about that, mm-hmm. articles written about that. I think the most important thing, you know, before talking about giving more than mm-hmm. what's needed, is we haven't even really, I think, in a lot of cases, been able to give what's needed.
Yeah.
And so I think when we can consistently do that, we can, I think yeah. it makes, at that point, it makes more sense to think about, you know, the question of more or not more. It's sort of, in some ways, I feel like it's as with a child, you know, who is just learning to crawl, and we want to talk about how they run. I think we need to optimize what we have, because there are a lot of good things out there. They're just not used as, you know, in as a widespread way as could be, I think.
Yeah. Margie in Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling to just point out that sometimes in the hospice or the palliative care situation, the family, there's a lot of guilt in terms of we have to feed them, we don't want them to starve to death. And yes, we know they're dying, but they can't starve to death. When actually part of the dying process often is just saying no to food.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think we need to communicate better with families what the dying process entails and what is a normal to expect. I remember one family meeting that we sat in on, and the family was really contemplating putting a peg tube in, or a tube into the stomach for feeding, and the man was clearly at end stage, and the doctor at the time was fairly young and having trouble saying, I think, what she wanted to say about where the patient was at. I asked if I could say a few words, and I asked the family if they understood what it meant to place one of those tubes, and what it would, it doesn't cure the patient, and sometimes it can cause problems, and sometimes it can hasten.
Yeah.
Right.
Margie, thank you. And I'm sorry to say we have only a minute to go, Dr. Chen.
Okay. Well, I think Margie brings up, underscores the importance of talking and of discussion with patients, with families, with doctors, because the more we talk about it, the more we can understand. And, you know, there are also cultural and social issues that take place, too. And I think one of the doctor's role, the healthcare provider's role, is to create an environment where people from whatever cultural, social, you know, et cetera, background can be open about their concerns, and those concerns can be addressed in a way that's relevant to them. So, yes, I agree with Margaret. We need to talk about this and be able to discuss things like, how does death occur?
Yeah, and you got a lot of people talking this hour and with your book. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you.
Pauline Chen is author of Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality. She'll be at the Harry Schwartz Bookshop in Shorewood on Monday, January the 28th, a week from today at 7 o'clock. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.